Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. Steve Nolan is our engineer. We invite you to join us as we examine the unvarnished truth about the drug war. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. Tonight we'll hear from Anthony Papa, the author of 15 Years to Life, How I Painted My Way to Freedom. We'll also hear from Sanho Tree from the Institute for Policy Studies about the drug war in Central and South America. And we'll hear from a medical marijuana patient who lives in the Gulag City of Houston, Texas. Her name, we'll call her Marcia. But first up, Poppygate. Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
On November 3rd, British Prime Minister Tony Blair announced that an assault on Afghanistan's opium trade is imminent. On November 4th, the New Zealand Herald reported that Afghan drug lords have been approached by American agencies in recent weeks and told to retire before they are targeted and brought to stand trial in American courts. On November 9th, the Pakistan Tribune reported that the U.S. is preparing to destroy Afghanistan's opium poppy crop from the air next spring before it can be harvested. The operation will be modeled after similar efforts in Colombia. The UN estimates that more than half of Afghanistan's gross domestic product is being generated through the sale of opium, and half of all Afghans still live on less than $1 a day. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
Next up, this interview I did with Anthony Papa, a man who painted his way to freedom after facing 15 years to life for possession of 4.5 ounces of cocaine in New York City.
My name is Anthony Papa. I'm an author of a new book. I just wrote 15 to Life, How I Painted My Way to Freedom.
Tell us how this began, if you will, this story that led to that sentence of 15 to Life.
In 1984, I got involved with drug activity. The biggest mistake in my life affected me and my whole family. I brought an envelope with 4.5 ounces of cocaine up from Bronx, New York, to Mount Vernon, New York. I met an individual who asked me if I wanted to make some quick money, and I said yes. I bowled with him on a league in Yonkers, New York, and I brought this envelope with 4.5 ounces of cocaine for the sum of $500. I walked into a policing operation. 20 cops came out of nowhere. Was placed under arrest. The individual who got me involved worked for the police. He had 3 sealed indictments. The more people he brought into the operation, the less time he got. The reason I got involved with drug activity, I was desperate for money and things were bad. I owned a radio installation place in the Bronx, and I made the biggest mistake of my life. So I was placed under arrest. I did everything I could do wrong, and I was sentenced to 2 15-year life sentence for a first-time nonviolent offense under the Rockefeller Drug Laws in New York State. I went to prison. I was sentenced to Sing Sing Prison, a maximum security prison in Ossining, New York, where I was going to spend the next 15 years of my life. I really didn't know what I was going to do with myself. I went into this very dangerous environment of imprisonment and really discovered myself when I found out I was an artist. That helped me transcend the negativity of imprisonment, helped me find meaning in my life. I discovered my talent as an artist through another individual who was a prisoner who taught me how to paint. And from there I started painting to transcend the negativity and to survive in prison. And in 1988, 3 years into my 15 to life sentence, I picked up a canvas, picked up a mirror, looked in the mirror, saw an individual who was going to spend the most productive years of his life in a cage, and then picked up a canvas and painted this painting called 15 to Life Self-Portrait. 7 years later, I wound up at the Whitney Museum of American Art while I was in prison, and I got a lot of public sympathy for my case, which led the governor of New York State, George Pataki, to grant me clemency in 1997. So I actually painted my way out of prison. I came out, really didn't know what I was going to do with my life. Went to a youth facility, a Spofford Correctional Facility in the South Bronx in New York City, and walked into an audience of 10 to 15-year-old boys and girls dressed in prison garb. So it blew my mind that these are the maximum security, future maximum security prisoners that were in prisons like I spent my time. So most of them were in for substance abuse problems. And I said to myself at that point, I said, I have to do something to change these people's lives. So what I did is actually, you could do two things when you do an extraordinary amount of time, like 15 years. Either you want to forget about it, which people most really do, or you face the demon head on, which I did. And I became an activist fighting the drug laws in the United States, specifically the Rockefeller drug laws, using my art as a vehicle for protest. In 1998, I began going to Albany, the capital, to meet with politicians, to Washington, D.C., and I saw that we really were spinning our wheels dealing with politicians at that level, that they were not going to change the laws, because at that time it was a political debt for politicians to get involved with the drug war. To look hard on crime was the way to go. So from that point on, I said, I have to change these laws, but not from the top down. It's got to change from the bottom up. So I started a group called Mothers of the New York Disappeared through the William Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. And we based our group on the Argentine mothers that disappeared, what happened in the 70s and 80s in Argentina, where the military took over the government and 30,000 people were murdered. They disappeared, loved ones of these people in Argentina. So who spoke out against them? What the mothers of those incarcerated. They went to the Plaza de Mayo and, you know, had candlelight vigils, showed photos of their loved ones, and then it got a lot of public attention from across the world, and actually fought the regime that way. So we copied that style, and we started our group in 1998. May 8th was our first rally in New York City. Every piece of New York press came, and from that point on we said, this is how we're going to change the face of the war on drugs, by putting a human face on the issue. And we were very successful with that, and in about 5 years we actually changed the way people thought about the war on drugs with these human interest stories. And actually that in turn made politicians react differently, because if their constituents wanted change, then politicians got on board. And so now 31 years into the Rockefeller drug laws that were enacted in 1973, a legislative intent at that time was to curb the drug epidemic and to capture the drug kingpin. It was a dismal failure. What it led to was the incarceration of many, many nonviolent offenders. Today there's over 19,000 prisoners in the New York State system, and 94% of those are black and Latino. 75% come from seven inner city neighborhoods in New York. So these laws have been on the books, like I said, for 31 years. For the last 3 years in a row, Governor Pataki, the Senate leader, Bruno and the assembly leader, Sheldon Silva, have all said that we want to change these. They want to change the laws, but they haven't. They keep bickering over what change they're going to make. So for us as as an activist, it's a shame through this political rhetoric that people are wasting away their lives while politicians argue on what changes to make.
Well, you're talking about these Rockefeller drug laws and the need for change, and how these public officials are beginning to say there is a need for change, and yet they remain deadlocked on that. They can't move forward. What is it going to take to move this off of high center?
Well, what is it going to take? It's not short of a revolution. I've been trying to fight this issue, like I said, for 7 years since I've been out. I know this issue inside out, and the reason why these laws have not changed is because the war on drugs fuels the prison industrial complex. Money raised from state, local, federal levels through the business of imprisonment. Since 1982, in New York State, 33 prisons have been built in primarily rural, upstate, Republican territories. So this is one of the main reasons that the laws will not change, because of the monetary gain through the business of imprisonment. I think right now what's going on in New York, for people who don't know New York politics, a couple of weeks ago we had a primary in the state capitol in Albany. This guy, David Soros, defeated the incumbent district attorney, Paul Klein, who was a staunch supporter of the Rockefeller drug laws for 15 years. And Soros, David Soros, ran solely on a Rockefeller platform. And he defeated this guy 2-1. So we sent a message to the governor and other elected officials and other district attorneys that, you know, we are going to continue to fight to change these laws, and we're going to do it through the power to vote, get used out of office, hurt you where it hurts the most, take away your jobs. So that's what we're doing now, organizing. We have a big event coming up in the State of the State in January. I teamed up with a couple of hip-hop entrepreneurs. Russell Simmons was involved in this, big hip-hop guy. Andrew Cuomo, who ran for governor, is involved. I work with a guy, Larry Goldflop, now from Baystar Capital out in the Bay Area, who introduced me to a lot of people. He's a hedge fund wizard. He knows a lot of powerful people. Matter of fact, he gave the book to Susan Hess of Hess Oil to read, and she said that this book should be standard reading material for all high school students. So my job is to constantly find ways of pulling people into this movement, constantly spinning it to change, you know, the way we fight it, but to get the issue constantly out there.
Now, Anthony, I know that you work to reach these younger people, to educate them to the pitfalls that are out there. And I want to address something, that it is the policy of prohibition itself more than these drugs that causes the problems. And for an example, I want to reach back to early in the story you were relaying how you got involved. You were a young man, you needed $500, and yet there was this multi-level marketing organization out there called, you know, drug distribution that lured you in for that easy money. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I was desperate, you know, young, stupid, actually, and, you know, for $500, I destroyed my whole life. But this black market's created, you know, by the government. It's been there for years. People get caught up, like myself, people who are marginalized, disenfranchised. You know, when I was in prison, I worked in the law library for 7-8 years as a law clerk. I never saw, I handled hundreds of cases, drug cases, and I never saw a kingpin. These were people who were juggling drugs to make a living, to feed, support their family. So I think it's a complex social issue, a multi-leveled complex social issue that should be addressed. You know, people should have more opportunity, be able to have jobs and education. But like, I fight the war on drugs in the United States also at the federal level. I work with November Coalition, Nora Callahan, and I work with Julie Stewart of FAM, families against mandatory minimum sentence. So these laws exist across the country, mandatory minimum sentencing laws. And right now we have over 1.5 million people locked up under these laws. And society's way of dealing with drug users is strictly punitive, and it's not right. Drug users today are treated as communists in the McCarthy era. Drug use is demonized. I also work with Drug Policy Alliance, a leading policy group in the United States, and we're planning a huge protest in January, along with the hip-hop artists at the State of the State, against the governor, to put make noise on this issue again, to keep getting it out there.
One passage in your book, and let's alert the listeners again to the name of your book. It is 15 to Life, How I Painted My Way to Freedom. And I want to advise the listeners out there that they can learn more about it by visiting Anthony's website, which is at 15 Years to Life. That's the number, 15YearsToLife.com. Anthony, I wanted to ask you about the fact that when you were first admitted to the county jail, you found that many of the prisoners were using methadone while they were in jail.
Right. I mean, that was a way of control. In prison, medication is the way to control the population. At the time I went into county jail, I was shocked when they were handing out methadone biscuits like they were candy. And all you had to do was say you had a substance abuse problem. And the reason for this is because they control the population that way. They like nothing more than to have people doped up, walking around like zombies. It was a form of control. When I went into the state prison system, Sing Sing, one of the most dangerous prisons in America. In my book, in fact, the chapter is called Swing Swing, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. Talk about how the prison was full of vice, female correction officers, prostituting themselves, selling drugs. It was a terrible place, but most of the people in there, a lot of people, when they have psychological problems and they go to help, they are medicated with psychotropic drugs and controlled like that. That's how the population was controlled in the maximum security prison too. The point I like to make is I went to Sing Sing, where they say if you didn't go in with a habit, you would come out with a drug habit for sure. Any type of drug you wanted was available there. In fact, if you can't control drug activity in a maximum security prison, how could you control the drug war in a free society? That's a point I like to make. My experience with the system, the way it works, is that as an activist, I want to fight for change. I use my art. Actually, the listeners, you can go to my website, 15tolife.com or 15yearstolife.com, and you can see my art. It's very powerful work, and actually it draws people in who won't necessarily get involved. My book is 16 pages, color photos, of reproductions, some of my work. For me, this book, 15 to Life, is a clarion call for reform in the United States. I hope to use it to get people involved, to understand the issue, you know, one man's struggle, you know, to find himself. It's about transcendence. I think anybody can understand that issue, you know, to survive a bad experience. So I think it's a great vehicle, great book for people to read if they're interested in finding out about the drug war. And my group, my organization, Mothers in New York Disappeared, which we've been in organized in 1998, 7 years, we've continued to fight these laws, and we won't stop until, you know, we change these laws.
Okay, once again, that was Anthony Papa, and his website is 15yearstolife.com. Now let's take our midpoint break.
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us.
Nobody can threaten this country. Oh, they may be able to bomb a buildings.
My answer is bring them on.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Weakness, nausea, skin rash, unexpected weight gain, swelling of hands and face, difficulty breathing, flu-like symptoms, sluggishness, dark urine, or pale stools, double the chance of dying of heart attack or stroke. Time's up. The answer, Vioxx. Another FDA-approved product.
You cannot lead if you send mixed messages.
My name is Santo Tree. I'm a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and I run the drug policy project there.
They think they're going to stop the rebels down in Colombia, that they've got them boxed in. Is there any truth to that?
Well, that's a pretty optimistic scenario there for the Colombian military. This is a civil war that's been going on for more than 40 years now. It's the longest-running civil war in the hemisphere. And no amount of military aid thus far has been able to defeat the rebels. We're talking about a huge landmass and very dense jungle. And you can hide a lot of troops down there. And the rebels are able to move with relative ease and escape detection.
There's no stopping the flow of the heroin coming in, the opium products coming in from South America, is there?
Well, not if you measure the street prices and the purity. No, it's by all indications a live and healthy and vibrant market.
Now, what do the recent elections at the federal level mean to the drug war? How do you see the future there?
Well, it's a little depressing here, right? You know, I work in Washington, D.C., and the mood here is quite somber. It's going to be very difficult to stop a lot of the really bad things from happening. It's going to be almost impossible to make any kind of good things, reform stuff happen. Right now, what's left of our system of checks and balances is left in the hands of one Republican senator by the name of Arlen Specter. He is right now next in line to be chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is a very important committee. And he is a rather liberal Republican. He's pro-choice. He's decent on a lot of issues, including drug policy reform. He's by no means a legalizer, but he's very reasonable compared to his Senate colleagues. And there is a movement now led by the religious right to try to unseat him, which would break Senate tradition. The Senate respects seniority for their choice of committee chairs, and it has never violated that seniority policy. The House of Representatives has, but never the Senate. And so the Christian right is mounting a very fierce grassroots campaign to knock off Arlen Specter as chair of that committee, to get his fellow Republicans to vote against him, which would be very unusual, unprecedented.
Insofar as Attorney General Ashcroft leaving and Bush's new replacement, what do you see there on that front?
Gonzalez's nomination is going to be, challenged. I don't know if the challenges will be strong enough to stop him, and I don't know his record on drug policy issues per se. You know, certainly his treatment of the Geneva Conventions regarding the Abu Ghraib scandal has not been very encouraging, and I suspect that's where a lot of the opposition will come from. There is an irony here, however. The right wing, the religious right, really wants to make a clean sweep of this past election, and that means getting rid of Arlen Specter, who they see as one of their major obstacles to overturning Roe versus Wade in terms of new Supreme Court justices and shepherding other judicial nominees through the Senate Judiciary Committee. And it's ironic, because if I were Karl Rove, I'm not sure that I would want to overturn Roe versus Wade. The radical right always talks about it. It's their red meat for their core constituency, the Christian fundamentalists. But if they actually achieve that, there's an old saying, be careful what you ask for. Because it's somewhat like the drug reform movement. Ask yourself, what is the most effective way to destroy or to make the drug reform movement go away? And the answer to that is legalize marijuana. The day that happens, I think 90% of the drug reform movement would evaporate, go up in smoke, as it were, and would no longer be as powerful a movement. And the moment they actually succeed in overturning Roe versus Wade, the Christian fundamentalists have no reason to show up at the polls year after year after year. So if they actually do get rid of Arlen Specter, this may represent the apogee of the Republican Party. because that army of right-wing voters doesn't have a reason to show up at the polls anymore, whereas the liberal voters will have every reason for the next decade to get people out there to overturn it once again.
Well, Sanho, I appreciate you joining with us. Would you like to refer folks to your website?
Sure. It's www.ips-dc.org.
One must be careful what one wishes for. You're absolutely
yep.
right.
You know, it's one thing for those who smoke medical marijuana in states such as California, Oregon, and Washington. But here in the Gulag City of Houston, Texas, many with debilitating diseases such as multiple sclerosis just have to take their chances. Here's an interview I did with one such patient here in Houston. Her name, we'll call her Marcia.
I am 40 years old, and I was diagnosed with MS when I was 26 after actually several years of odd things happening to me. I continued to work and finally quit working full-time in 1995, went on disability. I have something that they call, well, it's a no-no head tremor, because my head tends to go in a no-no, like I'm answering you in a no-no fashion. Actually, several people suggested that I try marijuana, and that they thought it might help with my tremors. I finally did. And I was quite surprised at how much it seemed to slow my tremors down and how much it seemed to help my whole body not feel full of spasticity or cramping, I should say. I have my legs feel as though somebody is trying to pull them off of me. I have a situation where I go to some of the best rated doctors in their fields, and marijuana is not an issue that they want to discuss, shy away from it, and that part bothers me, the intolerance.
Marcia, wouldn't they prefer that you use pharmaceutical drugs that don't necessarily alleviate your symptoms in the way you would like?
Oh yes, that is a really probably my number one complaint. Is if you I've had other friends who have told the same doctors that I go to that they use marijuana, and the doctor turns around and says, well, you think you feel better, but we have a better pill, or we have a better drug for you.
Marcia, let me ask you this. What are the, if you will, side effects of using marijuana? How does that impact your life?
What are the side effects? I cannot think of any.
John Walters, the illustrious drug czar of the Americas, when presented with facts such as Marcia has just stated, sometimes responds with, well, of course they feel better, but they'd feel better if they had a hit of whiskey or a shot of heroin. Well, I hope you've enjoyed today's Cultural Baggage and that you'll join us next week when we examine the unvarnished truth about the drug war. And as always, I must remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Jap dancing on the edge of an abyss.